Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, by the way, guys, the New Testament section of A Field Guide to the Bible is now available. I don't know if you guys checked that out or not when we did the Old Testament section, but it's been a few months and we've dropped 10 episodes on the New Testament. It's fun. So if you're looking for just a refresher on the Bible and you haven't checked out the Field Guide at all, if that's something you're interested in, the entirety of it is available now wherever you typically listen to podcasts. So go ahead and check out A Field Guide to the Bible. Chad's on that along with me and Eric. So it's a good time. Chad, we left off with Solomon being anointed king. Solomon deciding to not kill his brother, which is, you know, always a nice thing to do. Don't kill your brother. But also as a wise political move because, you know, he had some support for being king. So not a good idea to start your sort of reign off with, you know, murdering your brother. That's not the greatest look. So you might as well start with a little mercy. The thing that's weird about this is that Solomon is essentially king, but also David is not dead yet. David has ensured that the person that I guess he wants, but definitely his wife wants, and that Nathan wants, and some other people want, he's ensured that he takes his place by sort of giving him the throne in advance.
Yeah, sort of a co-regency, I guess you could say. And probably was, well, I don't think it is probably to it. It was a wise move given the fact that Adonijah, his oldest living son, was already basically throwing his own coronation party. He was like, I don't want to be king. Dad's never said otherwise. So, hey, let's have a big feast and we'll celebrate my coming kingship. So if David didn't want that, or if Bathsheba and Nathan didn't want that, then probably, yeah, that was the best decision to go ahead and make him king while David, his father, is actually still alive. But David's not going to be with us much more. We're going to encounter his death in chapter 2, verses 10 and 11 and 12. So it's coming up pretty quick. But before David dies, he's got a few things he wants to pass down to his son. He's got some advice that he wants to give. And part of his advice is going to sound very theological, very almost pastoral, Moses-like, almost sounds like the kind of speech that Moses gave to Joshua when Joshua was going to take over leadership of the nation of Israel. And nothing wrong with it. It all sounds very much like Deuteronomy. But after he gives this theological speech, he shifts gears and becomes quite the politician. And he gives him very explicit directives with regard to three people. Two of these are negative bits of advice, how to deal with these people shrewdly. And one of those is Joab. The other is Shimei, both of whom, of course, we have talked about before. And the other that he's supposed to deal positively with is a guy named Barzillai, the Gileadite. And we've met him before, too. So we'll get to those first nine verses, hear what David has to say, then the death of David. And then we'll see through kind of a strange series of events how Solomon, this newly established king, begins to deal with various people who are real or perceived threats to his reign.
Yeah, as David is dying, we see that the Simmel is alive and well in David. So he's got this sort of very saintly sounding words for Solomon, and then he has some very human sounding words for Solomon.
Yeah. Yeah, let me give you some God talk, and then let me turn around and whisper in your ear some real kind of harsh, bloody, political advice. So the symbol is certainly alive and well in David up until the very end. And his dying words, you know, listeners, don't make these your dying words. David's dying words is, "You shall bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol." That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's not what you want.
Not a good way to go out.
Yeah, not exactly the same as "Father, forgive them; they know not what they do." Or maybe like Martin Luther's dying words: "We are beggars all." This is true. That would have been a good one for David. David could have confessed that we're all
very
beggars.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. David should have just died praying Psalm 51. That would have been the best way for him to go out.
Probably so.
So first of all, in these first four verses, he's going to command Solomon to basically live according to what the Lord said through Moses to the people of Israel back in Deuteronomy. When David's time to die drew near, he commanded his son Solomon, saying, I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man. In Hebrew, that's pretty literal, just to be a man. Vahayita laish. Show yourself a man, be a man, whatever that entails. But David says, I'm basically going the way of all mortality. I'm going the way of all the earth. In other words, I'm about to die. So I want you to be strong. And that is a very Joshua, Moses to Joshua sounding term. It's the same verb in Hebrew that we have back in Deuteronomy, as well as the beginning chapters of Joshua. And he says, I want you to keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as is written in the law of Moses. A nice sevenfold structure there, by the way. You've got seven different ways of referring to the word of God. Charge, ways, statutes, commandments, rules, testimonies, and then Torah. So a good completeness there in that speech of David. Then he goes on, so do all this, keep God's word, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn, and that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me. And here he's hearkening back to 2 Samuel 7, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So David is basically saying to Solomon, I want you to do actually what God commanded back in Deuteronomy when he said, when Israel has kings, here's what they are to do. They're to make a copy of the Torah and to study it. That's more or less what David's telling Solomon to do, to know the word of God, to keep the Lord's covenant, to be faithful to him, and then to be the kind of king who will sit on the throne and reign in place of his father David. So, you know, everything sounds pretty good so far. I don't think there's anything that we could criticize about that very short and Torah kind of speech of father to son.
It is interesting that David believes, and this is true, that the king is sort of charged with keeping Israel's fidelity to God intact. You could look at this and think that, like, well, what David's telling him is to make sure that he obeys the commandments and stuff. But it's not just about that. Like, hey, make sure that you're a good and decent Christian man. That's what you need to be. I mean, this is really more about as you go, so the nation goes. Telling him to keep the commandments and to be attentive to the word of God is telling him to keep fidelity to Yahweh and not flirt around with idolatry. Because, I mean, this is the massive temptation. And thus far, Israel's been pretty good about it. They've had two kings that have at least not dabbled in idolatry, and it'd be nice if that kept going. By the way, Solomon does not do this.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It was only halfway whistling when his dad said this to him.
But
it's a great point to make, by the way, at the beginning of Kings, because that's going to be what we see, right? All the way through the end of 2 Kings is time after time you have a king, and you have to begin to think differently with regard to these leaders than the way that we think about our political leaders today. You know, so if you look at any poll, okay, how well is the president doing? Or if you're in another country, how well is your leader doing? Well, chances are, the vast majority of the time, how are leaders evaluated? Yeah. They're evaluated monetarily, right?
Yeah, economically. We don't sit around and be like, this guy's poll numbers are in the toilet because idolatry is everywhere. Like, that's not something, but that is the case in Israel. When God's doing the approval rating, the thing that he's looking at, I mean, it's not, oh, did you like mess up over here? Did you mess up over there? That's what the thing is. How we doing on the idolatry thing? Like, are the people worshiping Yahweh and Yahweh alone, or are we worshiping other gods here? I mean, this is the big thing, and you know it's the big thing because it's the thing that always gets them in trouble.
Always, yeah. So monotheism and monotheistic worship, that's a criterion by which all these kings are judged. It's never like, this king did well because he was able to establish a treaty alliance with Egypt or something like that, or whatever it might be. Or this king did really well because, man, the economy was just fantastic.
He came up with an incredible taxation plan that just everyone really thought it was fair, and they weren't getting taxed too much, but all the needs were being met. And what a brilliant economic strategy. No, none of that. It's how's fidelity to Yahweh going? That's what we need to know.
That's what it is. Yeah. And we'll see time after time where, especially the kings of Judah. I mean, the kings of the north after the split of the kingdom, they're basically all bad. I mean, yeah, there's a couple in there that God uses in some unique sorts of ways, but pretty much all of them are a wash. But the kings of the south of Judah, they're all evaluated according to this criteria. So how well do they do with regard to making sure that they, as the God-appointed leaders of the country, were keeping people on the monotheistic straight and narrow?
I mean, and this is what it means when David says, like, pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness. To walk before God in faithfulness in this context is just to walk before him and not anyone else. Like, to be faithful to him, not to be stepping out on him with other gods, flirting around with other gods, marrying up with other gods. That's what David is saying that God is asking of Solomon, to be faithful, in other words, to only have me as your God.
Yeah, as we've pointed out before, all the other gods of the ancient world were fine with you sleeping around theologically and liturgically. Long as you did some worship of them, that was fine. You could worship as many other gods as you wanted to. That's what set apart Yahweh. He was a monogamous deity. He wanted you only, and he wanted you to want him only. That was one of the uniquenesses of Yahweh.
Yeah, and now what you have, this transition here is hilarious based on what we just talked about. He's saying, listen, what you're going to need to do is walk before God with faithfulness. And me, as a man who walked before God with faithfulness, I have a couple other things I need you to do.
Moreover. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were a couple more things I needed to add. Besides fidelity to Yahweh, I need you to take some people out.
Well, I got
a hit list for you.
I mean, it is interesting that David doesn't think that telling Solomon to be faithful to God is in conflict with what he's about to tell him to do at all. That's how you know that he's really talking about worship here. Make sure you keep worshiping God. Also, I'm going to need you to do these things over here. And these things, they're not opposed to worshiping God alone. So he's not talking about, like, just make sure you always do the right thing, because he's about to tell him to do a bunch of the wrong thing. He's literally just talking about worship.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much it. So what are these other things? Well, we got three people that are addressed here when David talks to Solomon. So three different people that David has had dealings with. And as I mentioned earlier, two of them negatively, one positively. So verse 5, we'll start with Joab. Moreover, you know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed, avenging in time of peace. Avenging, by the way, is a bit too strong of a translation for that Hebrew verb. It just means, like, setting in time of, it's a very general sort of word, so avenging is a little bit stronger there. So avenging, or whatever, however you want to translate that, in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and on the sandals on his feet. Act therefore according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. I don't even know where to start with this. There are so many problems with this. The most blatant for me is the sheer hypocrisy of David.
Yeah.
Because talk about a man who is, he gives the picture here of Joab having the blood of war on his belt and on his waist. And he kind of pictures him as this blood old man, for one thing. He is an old man. I mean, he's been with David all these years. David's old. This guy, I don't know how old he is. He maybe, I don't know, 70s, 80s. I mean, he's an old guy. He's an old warrior, and David pictures him splattered with blood. Now, the man saying this, David, once wrote a letter to this same person, Joab, telling him to make sure that Uriah got killed in battle, a man who was totally innocent. So the hypocrisy is strong. on this one. I mean, there's a lot of things we could say, but that on the surface anyway, that seems to me the most blatant wrong that's going on here.
Well, I mean, how about the fact that you're like, you know, the things he did, these things were done a long time ago.
A long time ago.
And he's like, you know about these things. I'm like, well, why didn't you get rid of him? If these could it be that you just used him this whole time because you knew that he was the best general you had, and like that he was winning all kinds of victories for you, and then you were just holding on to this? And now there's a little conjecture here, but it seems to me that David has been out of shape, that Joab is going to outlive him.
Highly likely.
This is what it seems like to me. These are two old men, and David is telling the new king, his son, obviously, I'm going to die before Joab, and that's not sitting well with me. I'm going to bring up all this stuff. I'm going to want you to make sure that this old man doesn't die in peace. But, you know, be faithful to God and all.
It's true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose that, and I have read commentators that try and spin this in a positive direction. I just can't do it. For all those reasons that we just pointed out. If this was so wrong and this just so evil, just such a breach of loyalty, just such a horrific thing, David had opportunity after opportunity to execute justice against Joab, and he didn't, time and time again.
Yeah, and I think this has, again, this is a little bit of speculation, but it's based on just what we've read going through the life of David. I would suspect that this has more to do with Absalom than it does with Joab killing some guy that David doesn't really care about anyway. I have a feeling that David never really let that whole thing go, even though that was entirely his fault. And Joab only did what he did with Absalom. It wasn't like Joab wanted to do that. Joab was trying to reconcile the two of them. He did it because he had to, because David's entire kingdom was in jeopardy. But I don't know. I've never seen anything in the text, I mean, that says that David ever got over the fact that he knows that it was Joab who killed Absalom, even though it was David who put him in the position to have to do so. And we know that he didn't initially get over it because he removed Joab from the position of general after doing that. And then Joab just goes and kills the guy that he put in his place and just takes his spot back. I'm sure that Solomon knows, like, yeah, I remember that. Like when, you know, my sister got raped and then you didn't do anything about it. Then you banished him and then he came back and then you didn't want to see him. And then he tried to take over the kingdom. Yeah, I remember all that. Maybe David didn't want to bring that up to Solomon. So instead he's like, man, yeah, there was this time way back in the day where he killed a guy and it wasn't even wartime, which is insane coming from the mouth of David.
Yeah, I can't think of anything worse coming from David than that. Can you believe somebody killed a man in cold blood? Yeah, really hard to believe, David, that someone would actually engage in that kind of behavior. So that's only the beginning. So that's Joab. And we will see in the rest of the chapter how this all goes down. But that is the first directive. He's the first one on Solomon's hit list. Now, before we get to the second person that's supposed to be dealt with negatively, we'll intersperse it with the good guy here. Verse 7, but deal loyally with the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For with such loyalty they met me when I fled from Absalom, your brother.
Oh, there's Absalom. There you go.
So there Absalom shows up here. Yeah. But so if you remember that detail, it was during the coup when David and all his men had to flee, then Barzillai and some other people, but Barzillai in particular helped them out, brought him some food, took care of him. And then David offered to bring Barzillai back to Jerusalem to take care of him there and to reward him. But Barzillai is basically like, listen, David, I really appreciate that, but I'm really old. I'm not going to enjoy living in the capital city. Just let me stay here and die in peace in my home. But hey, take my son. And you can reward him, and he can be my proxy. And David's like, cool, we'll do that.
You know who else dealt loyally, you know, with David when he was fleeing from Absalom? Joab.
Yes, right.
Yeah, speaking of loyalty,
yeah, your nephew Joab, remember him? Yeah, just about as loyal as you can get with regard to to David.
I wonder if Solomon sit there like, be like, and how exactly were you delivered out of the hand of Absalom? I'm not understanding this at all. Like, you gotta
refresh my memory.
You gotta deal great with these guys because they were great to me in that whole Absalom thing. You're like, well, speaking of Absalom, you know the guy you just told me not to let go to this grave in peace? Seems like you would not be here right now if it wasn't for him. But yeah, it's just me.
He played no minor role in making sure you were restored to your kingship. Okay, so that's two of them. That's Joab and Barzillai. Now we have Shimei. So he says, there is also with you, now that with you is important. So there's also with you, Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite from Bahurim. So what does it mean, there's also with you? Well, if you go back to chapter 1 of 1 Kings, when we have the whole scheme of the plan of Adonijah to become king, we're told that some people were not with Adonijah. Instead, they were with David. And on this list is Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, and Shimei. 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 8. So Shimei, this guy that is about to be talked about by David to Solomon, he's actually on Solomon's side. So, you know, is he just basically a political gambler and he's putting his money on the guy that he thinks is going to be the best to go with? We don't know, but he is at least not anti-Solomon. He wasn't on Adonijah's side. He is actually on Solomon's side. So there's also with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a grievous curse on the day when I went to Mahanaim. He's talking about the day that he had to flee Jerusalem when Absalom staged his coup. And you remember that. You might remember that whole scene when, I mean, it is quite unforgettable. David's fleeing from Jerusalem and Absalom is staging his coup and Shimei goes out there and he's throwing rocks and he's like laying into David, cursing him up one side and down the other. David's who's the other nephew that always wants to cut people's heads off?
Oh, okay.
Anyway, whatever his name is, Joab's brother, he wants to go chop Shimei's head off. And David's like, no, we're not going to do that. Not going to kill him. And then afterward, when the coup fails, David's and his men come back. Shimei comes out to greet him and basically apologizes for what he's done. And David swore at that time, as we're about to hear, he swore at that time that he would not put him to death. He kind of a big clemency that was given to a huge kind of absolution pronounced on a whole lot of people when David came back to power. So that's a context. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, that is when I came back, and he apologized, I swore to him. So David says, I swore to Shimei by the Lord, saying, I won't put you to death with the sword. So, okay, David swore, I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to, in other words, exact vengeance against you for cursing me when I was fleeing from Jerusalem.
Swore by the Lord.
Not only, yeah, didn't just say, you know, I won't do this. He actually swore in the name of Yahweh, saying, I won't do this. Now, that's a weird thing to say, given the transition we're about to hear in verse 9. Now, therefore, therefore usually means that this is a logical conclusion. This is not a logical conclusion. Now, therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man.
This is not a good this is not a good absolution.
And I love this line, you'll know what to do with him. And then these are David's last recorded words. These are the words I quoted earlier that you don't want to be on your lips as you're passing from this life. And you shall bring his gray hair down with blood to Sheol. The end of David. That's closing words. So I suspect, by the way, if you're wondering why does he add with blood here, because back in the day when Shimei was cursing David, he called David a man of blood, basically accused him of establishing his kingship, taking away the kingship from Saul and his family by means of bloodshed, which of course was not true, but that was the accusation. So I suspect that's the reason that David throws in that phrase with blood. So one more old man, he does not want to die in peace. And he doesn't tell Solomon what to do. He just says, hey, you're smart. You're wise. you'll figure something out. You'll find a legal loophole here, so you'll know what to do. And as we'll see, Solomon does find a legal loophole, and he does come up with a way to deal with Shimei in accordance with the will of his father.
It's a good thing that the son of David doesn't do absolution the way that David does absolution. That's swearing by the Lord that you won't do something and then saying to somebody else, make sure you don't hold him guiltless. Again, this seems like David's just very irritated that there's some people that he is not going to outlive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably part of what's going on here. And
he doesn't want them running around the kingdom doing stuff with him not there to oversee it. You know, he doesn't. Who knows what this guy is going to do when I'm gone? I can't have that. So I'm going to tell my son to get rid of these two guys, because the way that David seems to think that he can die in peace is to know that Joab and Shimei won't be doing things in the kingdom without him there.
Yeah, I'm sure that David, still being very much of a political animal, realizes too, you know, these people are a potential threat to all that I've done to establish this kingdom, and now I'm handing on to my son, and who knows what they might do. Even though, yeah, Shimei's supposedly on Solomon's side now, what will they do in the future? And Joab, for sure. I mean, David has been afraid of him for a long time.
Yeah.
So, and of course, Joab was just most recently on the side, not of Solomon, but of Adonijah. So David is probably thinking ahead of time. He's like any sinner. He's got mixed motives for saying what he does. He's got personal vendettas. He's obviously been holding on this whole time to anger at Shimei for cursing him that day, even though he said that he forgave him and made the oath. He obviously has not let it go. So he's holding on to these personal grievances, and he's got these, you know, he's trying to think ahead politically to what might happen when he's gone and Solomon is king. So he comes up with this plan.
I mean, it is weird that he doesn't say to Solomon, you need to take these guys out because you can't trust Joab, because Joab's got the loyalty of the men and he already sided with your brother. So you got to take him out. And Shimei is a loose cannon, and he already cursed me out, and he will not be helpful to you. He's just going to be a pain as you start your reign, so you got to take him out. Those aren't if those were the reasons he gave, you might be able to say, like, well, this is, like, really, really cold, but it's just purely pragmatic. Instead, the reasons David gives is, these are immoral people. Let me tell you some of the stuff they did. That's wild.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Martin Luther from his Genesis lectures. He says, sin never wants to be sin. It always wants to be righteousness.
Yeah.
So, you know, David doesn't come right out and say what you were describing there. You know, take these guys out because I don't like them. I mean, I don't like what they did to me, and so just kill them. No, he's got to come up with pious-sounding reasons, because he doesn't want his sin to be sin. He wants it to be righteousness.
Yeah, you got to kill these guys. They are unrighteous.
They are, yeah. These are unrighteous, immoral people. So, yeah, David pulls a typical sinner move there. He is cloaking his sin beneath the appearance of righteousness. But it's pretty thinly veiled, pretty easy to see through what's happening there. So, we got to have the death of David. That's next, verse 10. Then David slept with his fathers, typical Old Testament expression, where you go to be with your family before you. So he slept with his fathers. That is, he died and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. So that part of Jerusalem. And the time that David reigned over Israel was 40 years. Another typical expression. He reigned 7 years in Hebron, 33 years in Jerusalem. You remember that those first few years, things were kind of touch and go, because you had Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, who was reigning over some of the tribes, and you had David, who was reigning over some of the tribes. And then finally, that situation was resolved, and David was proclaimed king over everybody. So, and then he took Jerusalem, became the capital city. So for 33 years, he was in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom was firmly established. By the way, that verb for established occurs 1, 2, 3 different times back in 2 Samuel 7, that text that I'm always referring to, where God promised to establish a dynasty for David. He says, I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. your throne shall be established forever. He says that in 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16. So that particular verb is going to be repeated here in 1 Kings to show that what God said he would do back in 2 Samuel is now actually happening. God is establishing David's throne. He is at least beginning to establish David's dynasty, which of course is going to go on for a long time.
I will say that as we sort of are done now with the life of David, and I'm sure some people would be like, man, these guys were hard on David. They're always pointing out like what kind of a hypocrite this dude was. And this whole time, my entire life as a Christian, I had always heard that, you know, David kind of had like one big blunder, but overall, like he was it, man. And like they're making me wonder why it is that the people of Israel were always wanting another king like David. I think now that David's gone, you do have to understand that there isn't another king like David in Israel's history. There's not somebody who has the military prowess that he does that makes Israel mighty the way that David did. David is unique in all those ways, in all the ways that you would, if you were just a person living in a kingdom. I mean, David is like he is the top. David expands the kingdom. He's undefeated basically, and so all of that stuff I think about David is true. David's a great sinner. He also pens the greatest words of repentance we probably have in the scriptures, and he pens the songbook of the Bible. I mean, or a good portion of it, a large percentage of it. So for all of those reasons, you know, David is who he is. And this is why he is considered like the greatest king of Israel and the one that every other king is compared to. It's not all bad with David. It's just because those things are true about David and those are the things that get emphasized about David so much, it is important that when you read through the story, you realize that that's not all he is, that he is also, a top shelf sinner as well.
Yeah, well, that's one of the great things about doing what we've done, too. Yeah, we've talked about this off air many times. One of the great things about walking through the story of David slowly, like we do, verse by verse, story by story, you know, getting into all these details. And I'm sure there's people out there be like, God, you guys need to hurry up. You know, get to the next thing. Well, one of the advantages of taking your time and just kind of stewing on some of these stories is you do really get to know David better. You don't kind of have the surface impression of him that is, yeah, it's pretty popular. Oh, David's a man after God's own heart. Well, yeah, not disputing that, but that's only one side of David. There's a whole lot of different sides to David. And one of the beauties of getting to know David the way that we have is that at the same time, you get to know yourself so much better. Yeah, people might perceive one thing about you, but if your whole life was written down, like David's life was written down, they'd know all the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly about you. And that's what we've gotten to know about David. Turns out, he was a fantastic, fantastic king, the best king that Israel ever had. All the other kings after him will be judged according to the rule of David. So they'll more or less say, so was he like David? Did he walk after the Lord the way that David did? Yes, no, a little bit not. So he does become the regal rule by which all the rest of the kings of Judah are going to be measured. But that was one part of David. David was a multifaceted person who, as we saw to his dying breath, was simple Eustace Tepecator. He was simultaneously saint and sinner, doing great things, doing very terrible, selfish things. But in that way, he then becomes kind of an icon of ourselves because we're in the same boat as David was.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, and it's encouraging because this is the man who God has chosen to bring his son through. He's like, this is the guy. If you go through the genealogy of Jesus, I mean, David is the standout thing, right? I mean, Jesus takes this title. I mean, he is the son of David. David is the sort of patriarch of the entire lineage of Jesus. I mean, obviously you have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but Jesus doesn't go around calling himself the son of Jacob.
And as I think I pointed out recently, I think it was on this podcast, two or three of the prophets actually call the Messiah David. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that Jeremiah does, Hosea does. But they don't call the Messiah by, you know, by other names of the people from the Old Testament, but they do call him David because he is so closely aligned in his messianic mission with David that he actually takes on that title of his father, if you will, since he is the son of David. So yeah, so for all the for all the ways we focused on many of David's weaknesses and foibles and sins, there's lots of parts to him, but he is the one that God chose above all others to be the black and white portrait that the Messiah will fill in with full color.
Yeah, well, and the thing that's important about Jesus or identifying himself with David is that Jesus is a king. And so this is why when they say he's the son of David, like they're talking about the kingdom. I mean, Jesus dies with King of the Jews, like placarded above his head. Jesus, when asked if he was a king, he doesn't say no. Right? That's not his answer. He says, "You say it is so." In other words, you've said correctly. You have spoken the truth. When people start to think about the Messiah going forward from David, they are thinking about a king because David is a king. You know, Jesus gets this this title of like prophet, priest, and king, and that king part is really tied, like begins with David.
Yeah, it doesn't so much begin with Saul as much as it does with David, because it's to David that promise is given about the establishment of his throne, of his dynasty. And so Christ or Messiah begins to be associated most closely with kingship. So when you think of Jesus Christ, you're basically saying Jesus King, the one who has been anointed to finally be that last in the line of David who will reign on the throne of David, but in a very different kind of throne.
Yeah. I mean,
he's first got a cross throne that he's going to sit on before he sits at his father's right hand.
Yeah. If you think of the Messiah as saying, well, the Messiah is the son of Abraham, which of course he is, you do not say, oh, well, therefore he must be a king.
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
say that. But if you say the Messiah is the son of David, you say, well, therefore he's the king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that brings us to. Brings us, well, just to the end of our 40 minutes, but also to the end of David. It's been extremely enjoyable for us to walk through this, and you know, to meet him as that young kid, that shepherd, all the way down to where he's at now, the old man on his deathbed, giving these mafia directions to his son. But
and it is
welcome to the colorful life of David.
Yeah, and it is wild as you go through it. I feel like we've been talking about David for a long time now, and I guess I forget when I'm just reading through stuff. As you walk through it slowly, it is a lot of ink that's spilled on the life of David. I mean, so much more than it is spilled on so many other characters. I mean, you get a lot about David. I mean, we won't get this much ink spilled about one particular person again at all.
No, not at all. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we said at the beginning of 1 and 2 Samuel that really these books should have been called 1 and 2 David.
Yeah.
Because he is the main character. So a lot of material about him. I feel like he is one of those biblical characters where you do really get to dig down deep into his personality and get to know him well, which is great because he's not a boring person. He is anything but boring. He's fascinating.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Next episode, we'll get into the reign of Solomon. We'll see how Solomon, we'll see what Solomon does with these orders that David has given him and how that plays out. Chad, I'll see you next week.
See you then.